So I'm speaking now with Danny Zalisco. He's got a book out called, it's called All Excess Occupation Concert Promoter. From, and the press notes say Queen, the Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd. He's been there, he's done it, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the unmentionable, including the Mike Tyson story, which I've got to hear. Joining me from somewhere in the States, and I hope you're looking out over an ocean view, because you were looking off screen there for a while, Danny himself. Danny, good morning to you.
Good to see you, man. How are you?
Well, you know, it's Friday afternoon in Spain. Where are you today, by the way?
I'm in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh.
So you'd have to go all the way across the whole continent towards California. That's where I am. It's a nice journey.
It's a nice journey. Yes, indeed. Well, it's looking very sunny there anyway. So, concert promoting, I mean, just the list, the stories. I mean, you've got introduction notes here from Rob Halford from Judas Priest. Now, this, who says, it's quote unquote, this book is one hell of a ride from a guy who's had one hell of a life. Danny, as you sip on your coffee, I mean, if Rob Halford, legendary frontman from Judas Priest, said you've had a hell of a life, how did it all start then?
Well, you know, as a kid in the Midwest in the early 1960s, we didn't have cell phones and iPads and all that kind of stuff, but we did have 45s and 33 RPM record albums. That's what we did. So when me and my brother first heard the Beatles play Please Please Me in 1963, a full 10 months prior to Ed Sullivan, and then we're going around telling everybody, you got to hear this song, you got to hear this song. And everybody kind of shrugs and go, yeah, that's nice, that's nice. What are they getting so excited about? Then Ed Sullivan comes, and the Beatles are the biggest thing in the world. The next day in our schools, everybody's going, did you see that last night? It's like, of course we did. It's our band. we felt ownership in that. And that continued all the way till today, where we're always looking out for great bands, great sounds, great things we can turn somebody onto and say, you know, have you heard this yet? And you know, they really didn't hear it yet. And they love, after a while, hearing things from you as a tastemaker.
So as explain to the uninitiated, for those who haven't been scarred by taking a band on tour or bringing somebody to their venue, because I was very famously told that concert promoting is a mixture of chaos theory and crisis management at all times. What is the if you can define the job of a concert promoter?
Well, how about this one? One time I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, doing a show with Carlos Santana. It's an outdoor venue called the Santa Fe Downs, a horse race place. And it starts raining, buckets, before the show, while they're loading in, setting up. So we're in the grandstand talking, and Carlos starts yelling at me about the rain. I'm going, dude, I can control a lot of things, but the rain isn't one of them. And with that, it stopped. It stopped when I said that. And we said, let's get this show started right now. I mean, he was on stage in 15 minutes. He put on a 2.5-hour show. The minute the last beat dropped, boom, it came down again. And those guys had a loadout in a pouring rainstorm. But sometimes you get lucky like that. You know, I mean, that's luck. I went from losing $100,000 to making 50 in one sentence. You know, I mean, just the way it goes.
So, I mean, everybody sort of wants to, you know, everybody wants to work in rock and roll when you're a kid. You want to be an astronaut, you want to be a racing car driver, or you want to be a musician. And you end up working. So how did you go from saying to people, well, actually, that was our band, the Beatles, on Ed Stewart last night, to actually getting involved with the business? Did you share an office with Alice Cooper's management? I mean, how did it all kick off?
Well, I just kept plugging away at it. You don't start doing this. I mean, I couldn't beg anybody hard enough to sell me an act to get started. They all said, we can't sell you nothing. You're not a proven entity yet. So I said, how can I get proven if you won't sell me anything? Basically, what I found out was these agents will sell stuff to you, but it's usually stuff that their regular promoters don't want for whatever reason.
Right.
It doesn't make it bad. It just makes it work. And a lot of people don't like to work. What they like is easy stuff. You know, give me some Rolling Stone shows and roll those out and put them on sale. That's just a method, you know, because people are going to buy those tickets and you just work that out. But when you actually have to get down and promote and make sure people are excited about a band, it's a completely different story. And that's my job, because all the bands that I work with, currently they're all pretty well known. But as the last 30, 40 years, if we don't have that building block of new talent for the future, we're all dead.
So how do you spot then? Because obviously 40 years ago, well, you said the book took you a couple of months to write, and whatever, 50 years at the heart of the business. How do you go about, you said that, okay, you know, Rolling Stones, yeah, they'll sell out. You'll get the corporates done. You'll get the VIP boxes, all that sort of thing. Santana as well to these days, because, you know, they'll play the big gigs. So how do you know perhaps a middle or lower ranking order, a rising band that's coming through, and how do you get out there? Because it's not a question of putting something on the internet and saying, I got 5,000 Facebook likes, therefore 5,000 people have come to my gig. How does it actually pan out?
Well, how it pans out is, you know, it really depends on how well known the band is. I mean, like I said, for the most part, most of the shows that I do anymore are ones that are already established. But my whole career, I mean, I've had the first play in the market of the Ramones and Alanis Morissette and Perry Farrell, Jane's Addiction, you know, some really, really great bands that, you know, you're kind of in line to get the new great bands when you're working with these agencies, because they represent all different kinds of groups. So you do a good job and they go to you. They know they can trust you. You're going to pay the band. You're going to take care of all your responsibilities, put on a great show and move on to the next day. And they keep getting new bands. So it's like a feeding process where we help each other. We make them look good. They sell me dates. Everybody's happy.
So what was the first time then that you thought, you looked out, you know, your band came on stage at your venue full and you suddenly thought, I actually can do this. I know I'm flying by the seat of my pants, but it's actually working.
I'll tell you what, that Stars Born show in 1976 that I worked on, and it, you know, I didn't put that show on. Bill Graham put the show on. I was his local guy for that show. I was maybe 21 years old at the time.
Wow.
And I'm with Barbra. Here, get this one. We're at the stadium, and Barbra Streisand hired Bill Graham to put on a stadium show so they could have the stadium scenes that you see in the movie A Star Is Born. Okay, so if you go back and look at that movie, the stadium scene there is down the street from where I'm sitting right now. And so I was hired to take care of Kris Kristofferson and Bill all week long, which was no little feat, by the way. Remember, this was 1976, 45 years ago. And these guys were nuts. I mean, I loved them, but we had a great time and we put on this fantastic show. By the way, the tickets were $3.50.
Extortionate. I mean, just I mean, how? I mean, honestly.
And the show is Peter Frampton, Santana, Montrose, Graham Central State. Right? But here's the catch. You had to be there by 9 a.m. and inside.
Right.
And then they closed the gates.
Yeah, but to see.
Because they wanted to have everybody in place. So those shots, when they were filming them at various times of the day, they would be full.
But to see Frampton, Peter Frampton, live in 76 and Santana in 76, I mean, you can, yeah, I'm Kristofferson, if he's pointing the right way up, that's fine. And Barbara, I've been there at least 7 in the morning to catch Frampton that period.
It was unbelievable. And then we found out on the day of, Barbara was going to go out and do a small set of songs and a couple of the new ones from the movie. She comes out and goes into The Way We Were, and there's 60,000 stoners in a stadium, and they were crying. When she closed with People, everybody, even the guys, even all the girls, everybody in the place, just sobbing, you know, and she goes, and she came off, she goes, not bad for an old broad, huh? You know? Fantastic stuff.
You mentioned Alanis Morissette and Jane's Addiction. I interviewed Stephen Perkins a while back during lockdown at his drum kits. I mean, that must have been because I don't think he's actually left his drum kit during lockdown. Full stop. I mean, he doesn't the best of times. How was it like looking after that other wave of alternative rock, if you like, with Morissette, with Jane's, with those sort of books, you know, that were coming up in the late '80s, stroke early '90s.
You know, it was a natural extension out of what happened in the 80s, all the new wave bands and different sounds that were coming out. I mean, the 80s were such a rich musical time period, like the 70s, like the 60s. The 80s were also incredibly sensitive, too. But, you know, these bands, they just keep coming up and they twist their music just a little bit to make them stand out and be different and have their own signature sound. Those ones that you were talking about, like Jane's and Alanis. And they were the perfect next steps for big acts to come out, you know, after what, you know, they had in the 80s. What they were following was their way of dealing with whatever it was that they're putting out earlier.
I mean, with the 80s, you have the stadium. I mean, stadium rock really took off in the 80s. I mean, people talk about, you know, obviously it was Shea with the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and playing the big gigs, but it really took off in the 80s. And you had bands like Motley Crue who were playing these massive stadiums all the time, all the way through. What's it like being involved with a band like, for example, sort of Queen? I mean, that must be, they played in Marbella in 86 on the Kind of Magic tour, and that was a huge, and they played everywhere else. That must have been a huge undertaking.
It was fantastic. And, you know, at the time, it was earlier in the 80s when I had them. It was their last time they played here. They weren't like a guaranteed slam dunk like they are over there. We get our things here. There's ebbs and tides where sometimes people go out of fashion, but it seems like over in Europe, man, once there's a commitment made by an audience over there, they're with them forever. They really got to screw up to fall out of favor. And, you know, in this case, they just kept plowing forward and they remained great.
And there's a cheese tray story in there, presumably, I think, about Queen.
Well, I'll tell you what. As a promoter, we're charged with catering the show. So we got to provide breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
The rider, isn't it?
For the whole entourage, all of Queen's people and all of the local people, because the local people, the stagehands, they can't leave the building during the day because they're setting up. So we feed them, we give them a 1 hour break for each, and they get to have their three square meals a day. Well, there's also the dressing room rider, and Queen had a thing where they wanted a cheese tray, but in English, the English language, the King's English, a cheese tray means mountains of mustard and mountains of lettuce and tomatoes. And I mean, that's a cheese tray. It's like all the condiments, all the different cheeses from all over, different jams, bread, toast, right? So the road manager, Jerry Stickles, who used to be Jimi Hendrix's guitar tech, he's now the road manager for Queen, and I like him very much. And I go, he goes, Danny, what do you call this sad mess you present us on the table? And the band's not there yet. I go, well, that's your cheese tray. He goes, that's a tray of processed cheese slices. That is not a cheese tray. He goes, dude, this is Queen. Let's live it up, huh? So I go, okay. So I go back to the caterer and I give him the whole wrap. About a half an hour later, I don't know how he did it in this short of time. He has five carts of cheese trays. And I mean, one is bigger than the next. There's sparklers on one of them, and he puts it into the dressing room, and it's like the 4th of July in there. There's so much food. So they're very happy. They go, God, this is the best one yet. They loved it. Everybody was so happy. Billy Squire opens the show. He blows the place away. I see the band right before they go on. Thanks again, Danny. We'll see you next time, because we're going to do a runner right after the show. We'll see you later. So they go on, they do their show, and Jerry calls me back to the dressing room. I go, well, I want to watch the show. He goes, you better come and see this first. And he takes me back to the dressing room, and those five trays were all over the walls. and he handed me a stack of cash. He goes, this should cover the cleanup and then some. I'm really sorry, but they loved it so much, they bathed in it. And then they had all showered before they went out.
Do you think it's something to do with the high stake? Because I mean, it is a stressful situation. Before, I mean, it really is. You're not a week before a gig. You may not have sold half the thing. The band may not turn up. I was working backstage famously on one event with Jose Feliciano, and the limo driver reversed into him with the famous words, "Didn't you see me coming?" So true story. True story. There was an awful pitch. Luckily, it wasn't going very quick. But in a high stakes situation, there is, and there are some egos involved. People do let off, don't they? They have to let off steam because going on when you come off stage, not just the band, but the crew, the sound guys, the lines, everybody's pumped afterwards. They've got to let off steam.
Well, absolutely. I mean, oftentimes the night doesn't end with the stage performance, but I mean, certainly everybody's geared up for it and they're pumped and wanting to do, a great show. It's a ridiculous kind of a life, being in rock, because usually you've got 10, 20, 30 other people on the road with you. I mean, think of how hard it is just for you and your girlfriend or your partner and you to get together to even meet on time for dinner somewhere. And we're sitting here herding cats, right?
Yeah.
It's what it's like. And they're going off in all different directions. And God knows what's happening back home. You don't know what's going on. They're out on the road for a month, 2 months, 3 months without being home, seeing their families in many cases. And for the most part, they're having fun. They're working hard and all that. But then there's those tours that aren't so much fun because there's bad stuff going on at home, and it changes your whole mood for being out there touring. So you've got to deal with that. These people are very, very real, just like the rest of us. It's a different gig, and I know, oh, woe is them, those poor rock stars. But they aren't poor rock stars. They're just really behind the scenes regular people coping with all the things that are thrown at them, just like the rest of us.
Well, the press notes mentioned that Bob Seger threw a bit of a curveball, and it also says that Van the Man, there was the shenanigans. Now, I've never seen the word shenanigans used in press notes before. So whoever handles the press notes, give them a round of applause from me, because I think that covers a wide variety of subjects.
Well, that is definitely one of my words. Yeah, there was a line I used to use where I was getting into somebody's grill and I'd say, "Your shenanigans are going to cost us the election." That's what happens.
So how was it? I mean, why did you decide? I mean, was it this book has been brewing, the raw material has been going for decades, obviously. Was it because of the current situation you thought, I'll write this because I'll put it down, because obviously nobody's going anywhere at the moment?
I've been thinking about doing this for many, many years. And just recently, I found an email that I sent to somebody that had about, I think it was 28 or 30 talking points on it, almost all of which are in the book. So I've been actively keeping track of the stories. I had a list that I would write, a catchphrase down to remind me of a story in no particular order. So I had that going in. All I had to do is get the stories out, record them, transcribe them, edit them, and then put it back, and then take 700 pictures and weave them through the whole story. And that's, to me, that was the game changer, because one of the things that I was held up for a long time in my mind, and this happens to me sometimes, it's not writer's block, but you get getting it done block once in a while. And in this case, I had the choice of putting, like you see in most normal books, 6 pages of photos and then the whole book and then another 6 pages of photos. And then you're constantly turning back and forth to those photo pages, trying to put a face to the name that you're reading about. And I decided to go through and put the pictures in during the story to help tell my story even better with less words. So and then adding to the words that I already had. And it worked out great. It cost me a lot more per book to do it that way, but I wanted to make it special, and I think it came out great.
You've also worked with some of your idols as well and icons. Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney. I'm British. It's St. George's Day. Right. Sir Paul McCartney.
And Sir Ringo.
And Sir Ringo, or Richard, is it, or whatever you want to, yeah. You've worked with famous people, obviously, through the decades, but when you get to meet bona fide idols like that, and we'll come on to the Whitney Houston story in a second, but when you get to speak to bona fide, are they just another act you deal with and you treat them in the same way? Or does the Ringo have to be treated slightly differently and make sure that the cheese board is absolutely correct?
Without question, you know, the stature of an act will affect how you anticipate his arrival. And for Paul, I mean, there's a guy named Barry Marshall that controls his tours. And so I have to report to him about everything. Tell you a great Paul story. A couple of years ago, he was coming to town and he had to have a certain date because he had commitments in the UK. So he had a certain date to rehearse. And the next day he wanted to play a show and open up in Phoenix. The problem was both arenas, there's two proper arenas here that he's played before, and both of them were booked on the opposite day. So he had to come in and play in the one arena as a rehearsal date where they completely set up the whole show, including the backstage, the dressing rooms, because this is like a dry run through for the tour. And then they tore it all down and moved it 20 miles across town for the next day, right? So after the rehearsal's over, and Paul comes off the stage, does about seven songs. There's maybe 10 of us in the arena, and Paul's playing 10 songs for us, whatever. And he comes over to me, he goes, "Danny, is it really true this place is booked tomorrow night?" I go, "Yes, Paul, it's very true." When the other people from the tour saw him coming towards me, they scattered because they figured he was going to grill me about this. But it was true. We couldn't do it. And he had to have a rehearsal. God bless him. So we got him a rehearsal. But that rehearsal cost him a couple hundred thousand dollars. And that's how committed he is to his shows. If everybody had that type of an ethic, we'd see some great shows. And that's why his stand out so much. He works hard at it. This guy's pushing 80. You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's perhaps the thing. Where do you think we're going to go then? I mean, it's obviously been a horrendous year because of what's happened. You know, from where your perspective, are you just looking forward to getting people back on the road again? I mean, there's going to be every musician I've spoken to, like I say, I've spoken to Stephen Perkins, I've spoken to both in the Europe and over in the States, and they're just itching to get, because there's only so much you can do from your home studio. There's only so many links you can send over the internet, etc. I mean, we're going to see every band literally getting on the road again, aren't we?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's firing up. The thing that's strange in our country, because it's such a large space, you've got places that are very, very safe to go, and you got other places that seem to be a little bit more dangerous. Where I'm at, we're kind of in the middle. It just seems like anything can touch that thing off and make it react. And, you know, as badly as people don't want to shut things down, and I'm one of them, man, I want to get back to work too. I haven't had a show since March 13th of last year. It's way too long, you know, and I'm just itching to get them all done. I'm optimistic, cautiously, that we could be back within a couple months.
And finally, the Whitney Houston and Mike Tyson story.
All right.
Come on, because I saw this 2 days ago, and I literally, we have a production office upstairs. I sit surrounded by things, and I started laughing, and I didn't finish laughing until I had my 15th cup of coffee for the day.
So she had a very big entourage. We were doing a show in Las Vegas at a place called the Thomas and Mack Center, which is where the big rodeo happens every December. And when you get into the airport in Las Vegas, this is the first thing you see when you come out of the airport, is this giant gray and red arena. So anyway, we're inside, and the road manager comes to me during the show. The opening act had just played, so it was halftime or the intermission. And he comes to me and says, "Miss Houston wants to see you." And I said, "Well, okay." So I go down to her dressing room. I've only met her once before at a show that we did on our first tour. And she just skips everything. She goes, "Did you see what's happening on my stage? Mike Tyson is on my stage and he's signing autographs and people are clapping for him and they're chanting his name. And he's on my stage and he didn't ask if he could be there. You go down there and get him off." So, okay.
Hang on, go and get Mike Tyson off.
Mike's not a huge guy. We're around the same size, except he's as wide as I am tall, okay? This guy this is a carved, chiseled piece of metal. He was so incredibly amazing. So I go to him and I tell him the story. I tell him what I just heard. He goes, okay, I understand. I said, and she told me specifically, I had to lead you down the stairs. Okay. And he goes, okay. He goes, be careful now. So we go down the stairs. And as soon as we hit the floor, boom, she hits the band. The lights go out, show start. And she had a vengeance. And she was like so into proving something. I don't know, to herself, me, Mike, the audio, whatever. She was amazing. After the show, she calls me back to her guy again. I go back to her dressing room. And she goes, my hero, as I'm walking in. She gives me a big hug. And the door closes. He goes, and now you're a dead man. I hope you enjoyed that. Mike Tyson standing behind the door. And I said, oh, you guys, you suckered me in here. You set me up. He goes, don't worry. I'm not going to kill you this time. You know, if it wasn't for her, you know. And she goes, it was your fault, Mike. You put him in that spot. it was a great moment.
The man who more just favorite moments apart from that one. I mean, favorite place to put a gig on? Is it Vegas? Is it West Coast, East Coast? Where would you say?
For me, it used to be Vegas, but it's really changed quite a bit. I mean, I still love going to Vegas and doing shows. It's great fun, and I'll have more shows there. I do like going there, but you know, the weird thing is, and I don't want to make it sound ordinary, but after I've been going to Vegas since the early 80s, when there were no rock concerts, and we forced rock concerts into Las Vegas in the 80s. And then in 1991, we booked our first of 5 in a row Grateful Dead shows that were weekends in Las Vegas, and completely changed the scene in Las Vegas. We took it from Wayne Newton and Sammy Davis to the Grateful Dead, you know, and people loved it. It became, there's like a generational change. You know what?
Just what was the Dead's rider like? I just got to ask you that question because,
you know, the Dead's rider wasn't bad at all. I mean, they have certain things like you got to have the stuff for Jerry Garcia to have his egg custards on stage. So his guy in his little guitar booth back there has, you know, the mixer and all the ingredients and all that stuff. So while he's also his guitar tuner, he's also making him their egg cream. That's what he called it, which probably killed him.
Yeah.
I don't think it was anything else. He didn't have a great diet, but what a good guy. Yeah. I remember I sent Jerry, he wanted to go see Siegfried and Roy and their Bengal Tigers.
Right.
And so he went, and the next day he was so happy. He goes, I got to pet the Bengals. I go, you pet him? He goes, well, through the window.
So Vegas used to be a good place, but because Vegas had been a Rat Pack town, hadn't it? You know, that dinner and a show.
Yeah, it's exciting to be up there. There's no question about it. But after all the years of doing it and all the travel that's involved, I have facilities right here in Phoenix that I love to promote in and that I can drive to and from and stay in my own bed. I mean, that's what I really like. But I do love going out. I did my first shows in New York in the last couple of years with some of my old friends, Gordon Lightfoot and Alan Parsons. And we're going around the country. I hope later this year with them and Jackson Browne and Frankie Valli and some really cool, you know, bands like that.
Well, it's an incredible life story, and I just absolutely love it. The book is called All Excess with Dollar Signs at the end of it. Occupation, very good indeed. Concert promoter Danny. If people want to find you or find out more about the book, it will be available as a virtual download from our website. But do you do the social media thing? Is there a website where they can find you?
Yeah, the website is called dzplive.com. And the book's available on Amazon for Kindle and a hard copy.
The book is called, and it's a download. It's also available to download from our virtual bookstore. The book is called All Excess, Occupation Concert Promoter. It's by Danny Zalisco. Danny, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Great. I'm happy to be with you in Spain today, too.
Well, hopefully we'll see you over here very, very soon indeed. Have a great day, Danny, in Phoenix.
I love it there. Thanks so much.